We're back again with another edition of Box Office Battles with Greg and Eric. I'm glad to be here. I think Eric's glad to be here.
Are you hearing music?
I am.
I'm not.
Oh, that sucks.
It's okay. What do you keep doing? Why are you changing everything up between shows?
I have no idea what's going on.
Also, I'm getting some sort of weird audio thing. Say, hi, I'm Greg, and I'm a nerd.
Hi, I'm Greg, and I'm a nerd.
Okay, there is a lot of interference going on with your microphone.
Is there?
And for once, I'm just happy that it's you, and that it's not me.
Yeah.
This is a professional show, folks.
All right, so I'm going to try to fix some things here. I don't know what's going on.
Turn the red knob.
Yeah, apparently my mic is not registering on my soundbar either, so I don't know what is going on.
Oh, Gregory.
Yep, it is crazy. All right, let's see.
How do you propose to fix this? Will you send me an email with 5 bullets? What a callback to 5 minutes ago before the show started.
I know, and that's what threw me all off. Maybe I should sign on earlier and make sure this stuff is working before we go on from there. So that would probably be a good idea.
I don't feel like you would have known that. I don't think you could have known that sitting in isolation. You needed someone like me to tell you the shit's all fucked up.
Well, the thing is, I didn't change much on the sound setting, so I don't know what it is, but it is what it is.
Did you guys have your very final Go Eagles Fly podcast celebrating and commemorating the Super Bowl win of this year's 2025 Super Bowl champion Philadelphia Eagles?
No, as a matter of fact, we did not, because
what?
We don't do a separate Eagles podcast. We just do fantasy football.
Oh, yeah.
So we transitioned to that a couple of years ago, and because it was just, we were getting a lot more viewers.
So, I would know this if I ever listened to anything you said to me ever.
So, yeah, we did a final fantasy football when fantasy football season ended. And so we'll probably do something when we come back, you know, to commemorate it. But no, yeah, the Eagles winning the Super Bowl. We didn't really talk about it last show. It was a good time. We enjoyed it. I don't remember anything after the third quarter because a friend of mine we were playing a drinking game where it was like where you buy squares kind of thing, but it was like every square was who scores first, who has the first down, who wins the coin toss, who's leading at the end of the first quarter, who's leading at the end of the second, and so forth and so on. And you had to, it was like 30 things, and you had to put either KC or Philly in the slot. And if you didn't get it right, you had to do a shot.
Craig, you don't seem like the target demographic for a drinking game.
No, the fact that I even had a Super Bowl party when the Eagles were playing says a lot. But I was like, you know what? I'm going to enjoy this. Win or lose, I'm going to enjoy it. And I enjoyed it. By the third quarter, yeah, I don't remember much. It's a good thing they were up pretty big because it was a fun night.
It was good. Well, I'm glad you had fun. That's maybe 30 years from now, as a Cowboys fan, I'll be able to enjoy the same thing. It's a nightmare over here in the sports landscape in Dallas as of late. Well, Greg, we are into our second battle.
Yes.
David Lynch films, the recently departed. For those of you just tuning in for the first time, this just in, David Lynch dead at the age of 72. And so we kind of thought, no better way to honor the legacy of one of cinema's greatest storytellers than to include in our podcast a battle of 8 David Lynch films. We watched 2 last week, our last episode. Lost Highway was one of them.
Yes, Lost Highway beat out Blue Velvet.
That's right.
The bracket is right now. Lost Highway is in our final 4 of the best David Lynch films. You know, and it was a close one. I like both of those movies quite a lot. And I think it was just the inventiveness of Lost Highway and the fact that Blue Velvet is so dark. You know, it's not an easy watch. So it's one of those things where you don't watch it a lot.
It's the Schindler's List of David Lynch movies where, you know, I'm glad I saw it. Mm-hmm. Not sure I ever need to put myself through the emotional torture of watching it again.
Yes.
So, yeah, and Lost Highway was just very David Lynchy. as far as I can tell.
Yeah, so without a doubt.
I feel like tonight, Greg, we've got one movie that is very David Lynch-y and one that's very not quite David Lynch-y. So we're going to get into that.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, these are the films tonight we're doing are our number one seed, The Elephant Man, do that again. That's like the worst elephant I've ever heard.
Okay, then you do it, asshole.
Oh, that's more like a donkey, I guess. I don't
know. Horse. I don't know. I mean, it was better than mine, but it wasn't. Yeah,
it probably was. I don't know. We could do this all night. It's the Elephant Man.
It's probably better than a couple of our episodes already if we just trade it off.
At an elephant competition. Everybody send in your elephant noises.
And it's just like the only one of our shows with a 5-star review on.
All they did was elephant noises, and it was fantastic.
You know, I really never heard the guys at the top of their game more. Okay, yeah, The Elephant Man, it's a story of, well, they say John Merrick, but I think it's Joseph Merrick. But
in real life, it was Joseph Merrick. That's right. Okay. And it's going to be going up against our 8 seed, Matt Kozman, our friend who was on not too long ago, said, ironically, Elephant Man was my stripper name, so that's good.
But mine was Vienna Sausage. Nice.
But it's going up against the number 8 seed, you know, which is the last seed. It's 8-1. David Lynch's Wild at Heart from 1990 with Nicolas Cage and Laura Dern. So different types of films, both directed by David Lynch, but polar opposites of one another.
These similarities end right about there.
Yeah, exactly. We're going to start with Wild at Heart because it's the 8th seed. We always start with the lower seed first.
Okay.
And this is definitely a David Lynch film from the opening sequence where Nicolas Cage plays our hero sailor, and he's at a event with his girlfriend Lula.
Seems like a nice affair all around.
Lula's crazy bitch of a mother, played by Diane Ladd. It really well, by the way. And somebody tries to off sailor and with a knife, and Sailor proceeds to beat him to death, exposing his brains.
The third of our 3 David Lynch films, 3 for 3 of exposed brain carnage at not even a minute 45 into this one.
Yeah.
Kelsey looked up and went, oh, went back to playing her little crossword game on her phone. Yeah, the 2 things I know about this guy, Sailor, played by the late, great Nicolas Cage. Career-wise, anyway. He is very violent, has violent tendencies.
Correct.
And the man loves some Elvis.
Yes.
And snakeskin jackets. And that's about it. Man, yeah, this one... I don't know, man. I don't know.
All right. I'm glad it's
not. I don't know.
It's just me. So it once Sailor kills the hitman and he goes to jail for manslaughter, the film picks up with Laura Dern, who is the Lula, Sailor's girlfriend, who has decided that she's waiting for him. Mom's like, the hell you will. I'm going to go get him. She goes to pick him up out of prison. And then our movie kind of begins. And it's like a road movie where these 2 individuals are basically running from her mother, running out there. And then her mother hires an assembly of crazy ass hitmen of all different shapes and sizes through her gangster friend Santos. That's about it. It just kind of roller coasters on through 2 hours of Lula and Sailor being chased by these people.
So I can appreciate that in this one, at the very least, we got some linear storytelling. That's always comforting for an audience, you know, just for the general audience. You know, this wasn't too much going on, and kind of like Blue Velvet and Lost Highway, really some really interestingly written and acted characters, some total fucking sleazebags.
Yes, yeah, for sure.
No one that you necessarily could have a 100% pure rooting interest for, it feels like. And that's good, because having complicated characters in a complicated situation is fine. I guess it just kind of, I mean, first of all, I would describe the film as like sleazy. Something about it was fucking gross. And this being chased by bad guys is as old as, I mean, the literary arts to, you know, to the movies. But I found, like, just trying to think of like any movie that they're on a road trip, I found Pee-wee's Big Adventure to be more engaging and believable than this. And not to mention the sequel, often overlooked and disrespected sequel, Big Top Pee-wee.
Big Top Pee-wee, yes.
Was also more believable than this. It's just like, every time the movie would seem to kind of even out into a way where, okay, now we can just take a breath and kind of move forward with this thing, then it's just some other dumb fuck thing that happens that never, I guess it's just the payoff for all of this zaniness is nothing. To me, it felt like zaniness for zaniness's sake. And then that's it. Now, I will admit, maybe I'm not the best person to sit down and have a talk about this movie, since it wasn't until after the film was over and the credits started rolling that I realized that one of the characters was played by Willem Dafoe.
Yes.
So
you didn't recognize him.
So, like, he's in theory, if that's
made up at that different, it looks like Willem Dafoe. He's not like John Hurt the Elephant Man. He's not got
president. So that's what I'm saying. If that's the kind of thing that could kind of slip past me, then there's no telling what else I may have missed in this thing. I guess I was hoping that I would hear from you that, well, Eric, if you'll just look at it this way, or you'll, you know, frame it that way. So okay, that's what I need to hear from you.
So let me attempt to do that. But the thing, the truth of the matter is, with Wild at Heart, when I saw it in the 90s, I was in my early 20s, newly married, and I was kind of, you know, envisioning myself as that Nicolas Cage character, into Elvis.
Okay.
No, I'm just saying, every 20-year-old, and I'm not saying I was Sailor. What I'm saying is, every 20-year-old has this want to be cool aspect of their vibe.
I can see that.
You're a young adult and you're watching things now that are edgier and they're cool. So when I watched it, I really remember enjoying it when I watched it on home movie, you know, on VHS. But I think I only ever watched it that one time, because I remember bits and pieces of it. But watching it again, it was, at first I was like, oh yeah, I remember this. Yeah, this is kind of cool. This is okay. And then it starts to meander, like you said. It grated on me a little bit. So Nicolas Cage's obsession with Elvis, that's true to life. That was actually his snakeskin jacket that he...
That is exhausting. Can you fucking imagine?
It belonged to Marlon Brando. So he was... That was his deal.
David Lynch is just sitting there in the trailer, you know, first day of shooting, just with his head in his hands, like, why couldn't we just hire?
Yeah.
Who else was, kind of big?
Kyle Meckland.
Yeah, just anybody.
There was a few people that were up for the role, but Nicolas Cage is clearly
this fucking guy with his Elvis obsession, and he shows up day one with his, hey, you think we can write this in, Dave? It's like, don't call me Dave. I'm not your Dave, bro.
He sings like two songs in it. Like a lot of films, when they're not a musical, you wouldn't let him sing as long as he did. He sings the full rendition of treat me like a fool and love me tender.
And love me tender.
It's
which one did you find more awkward between the two of them? The heavy metal band that stopped their show in the middle of a riot.
Or
standing on top of cars in traffic.
The heavy metal band,
love me tender.
The heavy metal band, the two scenes they did in the club were hilarious. But yeah, the fact that they're doing this like Metallica backing track throughout a lot of the film, you know, you get the, it's supposed to be wild, you know, it's supposed to be crazy. So yeah, and then he stops and he starts singing. You see the metal band in the background there. Then he starts singing Treat Me Like a Fool to Laura Dern, which, just like a woman, she gets pissed off about, because she said, you said your favorite song was Love Me Tender. How come you never sang that?
Yeah, try to do one romantic thing. And, oh, big news, surprising news, you did it wrong.
Exactly.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think one of the flaws here is that the movie kind of falls into this space that's between more of your straightforward bad guys chasing, I don't know, good guys, but protagonists.
Yeah, exactly.
Movie, or further on the reaches of the other side of like your Lost Highway type films or whatever, that really kind of start to bend the genre and, you know, some of that. And instead it just falls right in the middle, playing it too safe to be interesting, but too weird for it to make sense as a kind of straight ahead, you know, chase movie. So I don't know, but I mean, I must say, now the rating on IMDb for this one, Greg, is 7.2.
Yeah.
That's probably, I'd probably give this a between a 6 and a 7. You know, it has some redeeming qualities, I guess. You know, it's not one of those, you know, it wouldn't have fit in with the 8 worst movies we ever saw, which we just recently did. But some of these reviews are like 10 out of 10, mind blowing. Wild at Heart is one of those films that scoops you up and plants you directly in its own magical, twisted little world as soon as it starts. No, it doesn't. And if it does that for you, you need to go to your doctor and see if you've had a stroke.
Well, you know, when I was younger, like I said, I remember being fascinated by it. It was something that, so back in 1990, it was nothing, you don't see things like this. It was definitely not a mainstream film. And I think that that's why it is loved in the era that it was in. Watching it now, when we see movies like this a lot, weird, quirky, you know, crazy characters, like you talked about being chased, it doesn't hold up with those. And I like Lynch's style. I like his directing style, but the thing that I had a problem with the and Matt just came back with
Nicolas Cage. Why is it user review from in and then Cage, K-A-J-E.
Yeah, exactly. Weird. But I like Lynch's style, but in this one, where like say in a Blue Velvet or Lost Highway, where the visionettes, the little side things connect to the film, the story about Cousin Del with Crispin Glover and the cockroaches in his bunghole and making sandwiches, it didn't do anything. It was a waste of time. The car accident scene with Sherilyn Fenn, which is a beautiful actress, but the fact that they spend this whole time with this scene.
She's got beauty and brains.
Yeah. You were waiting. We were waiting for that, weren't you?
Since last night.
Well, she sticks her head right in her brain hole there.
I got something sticky up here.
Yeah. But what did it do for the film? It's interesting.
Isabella.
Yeah. Rossellini
is in this one. And the guy who now I know is Willem Dafoe comes in and just kisses her and then just leaves. That's the whole scene. It didn't do.
Well, the fact that she was the one that was called and given the other silver dollar. So for those who haven't seen the film, you know, Diane Ladd, who is actually Laura Dern's mother in real life, for all those that don't know, Bruce Dern, the actor Bruce Dern, who shot John Wayne in the back, one of the few men to kill John Wayne in the movie The Cowboys. Great actor, Bruce Dern, and Diane Ladd were married. Laura Dern is their daughter, and the mother is in dealings. She actually had her own husband killed, so she thinks Nicolas Cage witnessed it, even though he didn't. So she wants Nicolas Cage killed. She doesn't want him around her daughter. So she uses this guy Santos to send out a bunch of hitmen to go after Nicolas Cage, get him out of the picture, and bring her daughter back. So there's these two silver dollars that go out to two different groups of hitmen to take him out. And Isabella Rossellini gets one, but it ends up being Willem Dafoe, who we see there in the bottom right of the screen, Bobby Perdue, who is the actual hitman. So what was Isabella Rossellini's purpose in the old film other than to be a middleman?
She's a subcontractor.
Yeah. And then she has this relationship with Nicolas Cage, and you know, they were always supposed to tip each other off if there was a contract out or whatever. But it was a lot of extemporaneous type scenes that weren't as good as regular Lynch films, where everything kind of connected. It was very weird characters, great, but what did they contribute over to the plot, you know?
And I thought that this Willem Dafoe, who I didn't know was Willem Dafoe at the time, character would be the weirdest until the lady that you have here in the top left,
yes,
showed up with her group,
yeah, the guy on the right,
whatever. I'm yeah, and then there was a very enthusiastic African-American guy who was part of it.
Guy in the top right, Reggie. And
then, I don't know. You can call it
extemporaneous
stuff that didn't land. And I just kept calling it just dumb shit. Just dumb shit keeps happening. Now, that's the difference between you, an academic, and me, you know, a dumbass. But yeah, just, I don't, there was just so many times where I felt like, okay, if you'll just hang on a little longer, some or all of this will pay off.
Yeah.
And I mean, even to the very end, so spoiler alert, this movie came out 35 years ago. So
years ago, yeah.
Fuck you if you haven't seen it already. Sailor goes back to prison. He already went to prison once for defending himself. I don't know how that works out. And he goes back to prison, and then he gets out. What, this second time is 6 years later.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Something.
So the movie encompasses about 10
the movie. Yeah. Yeah. Because the
10
kid
years,
they have a kid, and it's grown up, or not grown up. It isn't ready to enter the workforce or drink beer, but it's 6 years old. Yeah.
I'm pretty sure it's a he. You just allowed to say that. Okay. I thought you were trying to be super respectful of,
because it may not
of gender.
Yeah, no, it wasn't. I was just saying they is, yeah, whatever. But yeah.
Okay. So, but I mean, even, okay. All right. So I cracked up so fucking hard.
Yeah.
About 5 minutes before the end of this movie.
Okay.
When he gets out of prison, she dutifully is there with their child to meet it. Yeah. It with it. And it. He says to her, I think it would just be, are you there? Are we?
Yeah.
Okay. So, and he says to her, I think this just, it would be better for everyone if I weren't around. Better for him, better for you, yeah, whatever. And he leaves, and all of a sudden some really rough guys surround him. Some gang members. And him just looking up and going, what do you fags want? Is, I mean, it was so unexpected and out of nowhere. And I mean, I cracked up. And please, no one write into the show.
Yeah,
I get that the word is problematic.
Yes.
In 1990.
Yeah.
I guarantee you a lot of people were calling each other fags that wouldn't do it now.
Yes.
But it was so out of nowhere. And so funny. Now, if that is problematic to you, as it should be, you should be happy to know that he immediately gets his ass kicked for it. But man, that was funny. Now,
that's after he gets his ass kicked. But yeah, the fact that these guys, he's walking out from prison and like 10 guys just come from all different directions. Like it's a coordinated attack. I thought the mother called another hit.
And where did all these guys come from? In Tuna City, Texas, or wherever the hell they were?
Yeah, they're Tuna. That's a whole nother part. We're going to confuse people.
Downtown to Tuna Town.
And then the Glenda, the good witch, appears and convinces him to go back to Lula and the kid. And to me, it was that the ending. Yeah, it was like the whole thing about she's waited for you twice while you've been in prison. What is your deal that you've got to walk away from your kid? You got a kid now. If anything, go kill the mom. And so you guys can live in peace.
Well, and she lost her mind. And so her
mother was out. Beyond saving.
Yeah.
But killed their own, their own parents. And the whole side plot of her being Laura Dern, Lula being raped when she was 13, 14. Yeah. And then her mother, having that, it was just a lot. It was a lot. And it was a
lot.
And it just kept being thrown at you. And I remember when I saw it, when I was in my 20s, I thought it was a kind of cool film. It was very edgy, something I'd never seen. This time around, I was trying to keep track of everything. And it was just,
this time around you eat dinner at 4:30 and have your AARP card in the mail.
The abortion sequence after she's raped by her uncle, the thing, I like David Lynch a lot, and this is why we're doing this, is because he's
done like abortion a lot, so I'm surprised that this scene didn't really resonate with you.
It saved me a lot of money over the years, but anyway. But the thing is that I like David Lynch. I love most of the films in this list, and I did like this film, and I still kind of like it, but the dude definitely, he does some freaky stuff. You knew he did some freaky stuff. You watch these films and you see some of these scenes and, somebody writes and directs what they know and he knows some freaky stuff. So it's like this obsession with the child rape and the abortion. It's just, whew. And going back to Blue Velvet didn't have a lot of that in it, but it had sadomasochism. It had brutality against women. It was just overall kinkiness, and so that's kind of this general theme that goes through some of these films. And this film, though, the kinkiness isn't attractive, especially if it's not between Lula and Sailor. Even the stuff between Lula and Sailor isn't that attractive. It kind of reminded me of The Room when we did that a few weeks ago, where it was like every 5 minutes they had another sex scene with Lula and Sailor, and I'm like, what are they going for here? Why is it every 5 minutes they have to pay? I didn't get it.
I mean, David Lynch is known for fucking brains everywhere and fucking people's brains out everywhere. Yeah. But I wonder, there seems to be this bleak romance thing. It was definitely in Blue Velvet.
Yeah.
And we see it here, this bleak romance. Lost Highway, a bleak romance. So, there's something to that. Maybe the guy is just unlucky in love, and this is how he manifests that into the world with some of the most fucked up shit you ever saw in your whole life. They said the book is almost a porno.
Yeah,
Kriplius says that. Yeah. I was reading that, the book was written and everyone was falling all over themselves to make this movie. And as I was watching the movie, I just wondered to myself, this book must have fucking sucked. Because it's one thing to watch it, and at least if you have someone like a David Lynch or a Baz Luhrmann or a Wes Anderson, somebody who has a really specific and unique vision and way of storytelling and a visual identity, at least if you get someone like that on board, you're guaranteed to have something at the end.
Right.
But that doesn't make it a good movie. And I really just, this just isn't a good movie. It's just not that good. It's number 8 on our list. I don't know how many movies in total David Lynch made, and I'm not going to go.
Not much more than 8. Because we had Dune as well, and then there was some other things that he did later on in life, short films and stuff like that. So when I looked this up, this was, you know, so it was quality over quantity. You know, I wouldn't go far as say this is a bad film, but it's something that I wouldn't.
Is it a good film?
I wouldn't recommend. It's somewhere in between. It's something where you can get some things out of it, but there's some things to see that's like, okay, well, that's, I've never seen this before in a film, but like Willem Dafoe's Bobby Peru character.
Was that who that was? No shit.
Yeah, the prosthetic teeth. It was his character is, to me, was fascinating because he's so, everything that Willem Dafoe is in, to me, is fascinating.
Where he cornered her and kind of started this.
Yes.
And started to coerce her and or forcefully coerce her into asking him for sex.
Yes.
And then at the end, him going, well, I got some shit to do. I'm out
of here.
I was horrified by that.
That is a demented scene. You know, the whole thing with them in the, kind of in the Hope Motel, area where they're all sitting there drinking and smoking, and then the hefty girls come out, and it's just this one big parade of weirdness. It's a very uncomfortable type scene. You don't know what's going on. You can clearly tell that Lula is uncomfortable and wants to remove themselves from the situation, and then it just gets worse.
Say what you will about David Lynch, either at an individual movie level or his overall body of work.
Yeah.
But Wild at Heart and Blue Velvet had a scene in it that were really, I mean, as off-putting and terrifying as they are, to see them and have that kind of reaction is a testament to his talent in movie and the actors too, and the way it was written. But the first time that we see Dennis Hopper in Blue Velvet with his mask and the mommy stuff and the, you know, the rape, you know, and then this one with that pretty long, coercive, frightening dialogue between them.
Yeah.
I mean, that is some tough stuff to get through. But I mean, very powerful scenes
without a doubt. Yeah. And you know, I think when Willem Dafoe does enter the picture and knowing that he was in it and not having watched this for a while, I was kind of waiting for Willem Dafoe, if I'm going to be quite honest, because I do enjoy what he does. And when he comes in, it does make the film more interesting, if not just more demented. And the whole sequence where he convinces Sailor to rob the bank and it all goes haywire is probably one of the more interesting and watchable parts of the film. Yes. You know, and once Willem Dafoe's character is gone, then it just kind of again starts to meander a little bit and kind of bogs itself down to where, you know, Sailor goes back to prison and then we have the whole ending scene. So it just kind of fizzles out. The fact that like Diane Ladd, the mother, never really gets her comeuppance to me. And she's the architect of most of this stuff. The whole scene with the lipstick, painting her whole face with the lipstick. I will give credit where credit is due. Diane Ladd is amazing in the film.
She is good.
She does pull off psycho crazy mama like I've never seen. And very insecure. The fact that she wants Harry Dean Stanton, her buddy Johnny, to go get him, but then Santos wants him killed, but she doesn't want him killed. You know, the whole struggling with the fact that her boyfriend is going to be murdered to please her other boyfriend. She pulls it off really well. She's just a nut job. She's basically a nut job, but she never really, you know, faces any circumstances for what happens. So at least that I got that was worth.
Yeah, we like that kind of closure, don't we?
Yeah.
You want to see people get their comeuppance. That's such a good word. And not easily replaced, you know, but we want people to suffer for their sins. And yeah, I don't know. The whole thing felt flimsy to me.
Yeah.
And I had watched The Elephant Man, which we're about to get into the night before. And I don't know. There's just a big difference. I mean, we said at the top of the show, they're both directed by David Lynch. That's where the similarities end. Visually, storytelling-wise, the, you know, characters. So, yeah, I don't know. Wild at heart. It's an 8 seed. The 8 seed only on the rarest of occasions will beat the number 1 seed. You got to be a really good 8 seed to do that. I'm not sure Wild at Heart was the one, but we'll find out here shortly.
Well, I will say this is that this movie was made in 1980, The Elephant Man, and it did extremely well back then. It was very critically acclaimed, won several awards. Anthony Hopkins is just amazing in it, but it's pretty well beloved. And my wife is kind of on this David Lynch thing that when we were starting it, she'd start watching the movies with me, and David Lynch is not necessarily her bag. So about 30 minutes or so in, she taps out. Now, she had seen The Elephant Man when she was younger, but it had been years. So we watched that together, and she sat through the whole thing, and you could have heard a pin drop. It was quiet as a mouse. I turned to her about halfway through, and this is the best compliment I can give The Elephant Man before we get into it. Mm-hmm. I had like a tear welling up in the side of my eye almost the entire film. Yeah. Almost the entire film. I was in this state of both sadness and happiness that it puts you through. Pity, you know, gratefulness for what I have and the life that I've been able to lead. It's just, it tells such a resounding message that if you see it today, and it's very impactful on what it's trying to say. And I think David Lynch, if I have to say anything, this is a masterpiece to me. Watching it just over this weekend, when it was over, it's one of those movies I said, I can judge a good movie is when the credits start rolling and I don't do anything. I don't move. I am letting the credits run so that I can absorb what I just saw and just kind of come to a closure with it. And damn, if this one didn't do it for me, but it's just an exceptional film.
It was a very moving film. I hadn't seen it before. In 1980, I would have been 3. So now I'm familiar with the story of Joseph or John Merrick and his either being or his story makes its way into pop culture every now and again. There's a Bare Naked Ladies song that mentions, you know, John Merrick's remains, and you know, it'll show up every now and then. What I really appreciate, everything you said about the film is correct. It was moving. It was haunting. We know we can't hide ourselves away from the fact that these types of things still happen every day. The capacity for humans to treat other humans. And this is something we talked about actually in Schindler's List, the capacity that we have to treat other humans horribly is probably one of the things we're best at as a human race, is coming up with new and creative ways to just shit on somebody else,
right?
To punch down. And are we ever good at it? But what I appreciated about it was that David Lynch, who, as we just saw in Wild at Heart, although that was 10 years later, have we seen in the other two movies, can have a tendency to have all of the delicacy of a sledgehammer, was so even-handed with this. He wasn't begging you to feel a certain way. He could have made this a lot sadder. I mean, you talk about watch a movie with a tear in your eye the whole time. He could have made it sadder and you know, whatever. It was even-handed, and it let you slowly come to your own realization, at least I did as I watched it, of kind of like peeling an onion. You know, we started with a freak show scene, a guy getting into a freak show, you know, to see it. It was not uncommon at the time. And as you start to peel back some of the layers of this is actually a human being. Well, how can you nurture a human being who's been mistreated for so long? We find out that John Joseph Merrick is actually a really intelligent guy, but they don't know that at the time. He's not treated that way. I guess I just appreciated that it was kind of, this is a movie, I mean, I think that not a lot, quote unquote, happens. And I don't know that you're going to leave it feeling entertained necessarily, but it was still just an interesting character study. It was very moving, very poignant. And like I said, I thought it was really even-handedly done.
Yeah, I think, like you said, a lot of things don't happen, but I think that what does happen is subtly profound. Everything, every little scene that they have can be deconstructed as being just another example of the Merrick's humanity,
yes,
his spirit, what he was trying to do in his life. One of the things that I pointed out to my wife is that Lynch does there's other auteurs that have done where eyes are the windows to the soul type thing, but mm-hmm. Lynch really like shows it off here. Yes. And the one thing that I noticed about the film was, you know, the film starts with Merrick's mother, apparently. You have the photograph and then her attack. Merrick himself had even said that his mother was attacked by an elephant, never really proven, but that's what he's going for. This is kind of, you know, where he got his condition, which really developed. We don't want to get into specifics on the real story, but you get these eyes where his mother has these beautiful eyes. And it's a theme that goes throughout the entire film, because when Anthony Hopkins first sees him, the doctor, that he just wants to, he's one of these surgeons or these specialists that I think he's looking for freaks to kind of exhibit to his community,
you know,
this freak show kind of out of curiosity. Cause when you see him, he's just wandering around and he sneaks back specifically to get a look at Merrick. But what's interesting is when he convinces later on, he convinces Bites, the guy who controls Merrick, to let him see it. That scene to me, like I said, it's so profound. And again, it has a lot to do with eyes. And I explained it to my wife like this. I said, it's just so simply done where you take a wide shot and you zoom in on a character's eyes and you get that single tear that comes from Anthony Hopkins as he's seeing Merrick for the first time.
Yeah.
And it's very, very powerful. It's very well done. And in that moment, you know that Hopkins is kind of in. Hopkins is going to be a part of this guy's life.
He's in, and he treats him with respect. I didn't see, I mean, yes, he wants to exhibit it to his peers, but it never occurred to me as I was watching it that it seemed voyeuristic.
Right.
It seemed very much more educational and academic, and that if we are to uphold our promise to the world as physicians, then we need to be willing to take in this type of information, as uncomfortable as it is, as shocking as it is, as maybe out of the ordinary as it is, and you will likely not have a patient with exactly, you know, this condition. But just it to me, it always seemed not self-serving, not voyeuristic, but just educational. And because, like you said, that scene he was in, it was like he fell in love with the person that this is. And this is before we find out that he has, you know, some talents and some intelligence, maybe unexpectedly.
Right.
And yeah, I just, it's hard to watch a movie like that and not, like Mike Florida says in the chat, you know, just kind of start to take an accounting of your own life and the way that you've treated people. Obviously, we can't go back in time and change all of the times that we were hurtful or unnecessarily nasty to somebody. And there are times throughout history that we're told that being empathetic is a weakness, and it is not. And so, yeah. For those who haven't seen this, I mean, I would, you know, we would talk about eight movies in every matchup we do. And I don't know that you and I would necessarily recommend everyone go watch every one of these movies every time. We do, because we have a show together. We need to talk about these films with some amount of knowledge.
Right.
This one I would recommend. It kind of is a level set for like who you are as a person. What do you want to be? Yeah. What kind of person do you want to be from the time you see this movie to, you know, the end of your life, right?
Yeah.
And, yeah, it's really moving.
Without a doubt, probably one of my favorites that we've watched on this show. We were in our 18th episode, and this is probably one of my favorites. And I had seen it years ago, but it had been a long time. I don't even know if I appreciated it when I saw it when I was younger. I remember liking it and thought it was very engaging and gut-wrenching at times. But the thing about the movie, like you said, there's so many things that they build up to it. When you first see Merrick, he is a monster, or they, you know, you see him in this horrible environment in this cellar where he just looks hideous. And that's the first impression you get. And so what's unique is that the doctor feels pity and it brings him to tears, where most people, when they see Merrick for the first time, they shrink away or they scream or something to that. But then it gradually, as you build up to getting to know John Merrick in the film, it, like you said, it peels away his identity to where you realize what a beautiful human being is. And by the end of the film, regardless of his disfigurement, you don't even notice it anymore or see it anymore. At least I didn't.
Yeah.
As a disfigurement. You saw it as just the character who is, by the end of the film, you're falling in love with him. He is lovely. And so getting back to the eyes thing is like when Merrick first shows up, when you first see him, he has the sack over and you can't even see his eyes.
Yeah.
And it makes a big difference, because when he is like this, he doesn't have a particular identity. But then when he gets to meet with the doctor and you get to see him, his eyes, they shine. It's almost like they've got little lights in them. And so I noticed it. I kept pointing it out. Look at his eyes sparkle. He's got the most beautiful eyes. And the way that John Hurt plays him is so endearing. And it becomes that when you get into this friendship with him and Anthony Hopkins, it becomes very touching because it seems genuine. The two actors have a great chemistry. And they do a lot together that it just seems to work for me.
I could barely recognize them as John Hurt in this one.
Well, he didn't have an alien bursting from his stomach.
So that's two movies this time around where a character, really an actor, slipped by me. Unrecognizable.
Yeah. It was actually Willem Dafoe that played John.
You know, could have fooled me. Yeah. You know, but in the end, John Merrick's giant head was obviously the source of a lot of ridicule throughout his life. Also ended up killing him, Greg.
Well, I mean, the fact that he got to live a relatively humane life at all, you know, some sort of semblance of a life, and actually had people that cared about him in that time frame.
Yes. Yeah.
Remarkable, because a lot of the people that are, because the movie is actually taken from the memoirs, and I read a lot about the memoirs themselves from the doctor, not from Merrick.
Yes.
And so we get that side of the story, but it was clear from the memoirs that he did have people who actually genuinely cared about him. Mrs. Kendall, who was played by Anne Bancroft, she's the theater actress. Mm-hmm. She's outstanding. Yeah. She is genuinely like a person that was in his life that was able to see past the disfigurement and be able to go and visit him, you know, and it wasn't like she was doing it for publicity. She genuinely just spent time with him. And the scene that they have where they read Shakespeare, they read Romeo and Juliet, it's so extremely well done. And it's so professionally made. And the kiss she gives him on the cheek is just one of those awe moments where it's, mm-hmm. you know, that it's just a friendship, somebody that's looking out for him. So I really enjoyed her performance. What is gross?
I mean,
genuine friendship.
It's nice for the movie and all this kiss, but as opposed to Wild at Heart, the movie where I couldn't find any characters that I wanted to root for, this one's filled with characters who not only do you want to root for, I liked. They go out of their way to make the villains very, very obvious in this one. You know, it's just like, well, if there's a bunch of people being nice to him, we got to have somebody who's mean or trying to take advantage of him. And it's very black and white, as is the movie. So no one really has. I don't really see anybody that has a journey from I didn't like him to I do. Most of the people in the beginning of the movie that liked him,
I thought that the one of the ones I really enjoyed was the nurse that when she first sees him,
she was just scared of him. But
yeah, well, that's a big thing that they bring this person in there, and she did not see him. She like they have the whole scene where she tells the girl, "You're going to stay with me if we're going to do this. You know, if we're going to make up his room and everything." But she warms to him. I also thought that the head nurse had mm-hmm. a pretty decent, even though mildly, you know, type of story arc where she at first is kind of just cold. She tells him that he doesn't belong here, but then she ends up becoming extremely protective of Merrick.
Well, that's what I mean. You know, it's human nature to like have an immediate reaction and then go, okay, all right. Everybody settle down. You know, and just get into it. But, you know, we have some characters who are only interested in taking advantage of them for their own financial gain. Right. It starts that way. And you got this other dickweed, you know, who's selling tickets like clandestinely. Show them off at night, you know. And but for the most part, I mean, there's any number of characters where you're just, you know, the doctor and John Merrick being the main two, where it's just like, wish nothing but the best for these people. And from what I understand from reading various things, the doctor did go on to have a very established and very prestigious career as a physician, and ended up being like a royal physician for the royal family. Was able to retire early when he saved one of the royals' life during a appendicitis or something or other. So he had a really great life, and I was hoping that that's how the story would end, right? You can't expect, and is often the case with diseases like this. I think we saw it with The Mask, with Cher and the Rocky Dennis story. Mm-hmm. Like, there's very clearly physical abnormalities or deformities, but if that were just it, you know, you could live to be 100, you know, just like a normal person can. Right, but these things always tend to have life-shortening qualities about the disease. You know, it's just kind of part of it the way it is. So, I had hoped that I would either watch the movie and we're only watching a snapshot in time of John Merrick's life, and that I would go on to read that he lived to be 80 and opened a bakery in, you know, the south of France or something. That's not what happened, sadly.
And oddly enough, sold elephant ears at the bakery.
He had a gardening shop.
No, that did not how is not how it worked out. But you know the thing. Going back to the head nurse, I thought it mother's head. I guess was what they called her. But she, I thought what was unique about the character was she never shows him affection. But at first she doesn't want him there. But then later, when she's the one who questions Treves, Anthony Hopkins, the doctor, questions his intentions for Merrick, and that when he becomes a celebrity, that's when Treves starts to doubt himself, because then you start bringing in all of these people of the upper crust that sit with him and have tea, and now he becomes an exhibit all over again. And I really love the scene where Treves is sitting in the dark and he's questioning, am I a good person?
Yeah.
Am I good or am I bad? Because he's not sure. And that tells you that he's good. And his wife, like, don't be ridiculous. Yeah. You're a good man. So
if you I think that capacity to question.
Right.
Generally speaking, you're on the right track. Yeah.
That's your answer. But the mother's head character, her love language was one of protection. Didn't show affection, but she steps in and starts really looking out for Merrick, which is, you know, I think kind of a change in their demeanor. But that all being said, let's talk a little bit about probably my favorite character outside of Treves and Merrick, and that's Cargom, played by Sir John Gielgud, who, if you know Arthur, the movie Arthur, was the butler Hobson. Fantastic. He's my favorite character in the film. He has so many great, these little bit of sarcasm, the line that he comes up, like the scene in the top left here where he's taking food up to Merrick. He takes it from him and he goes, you don't want to eat this. This is
don't slop. Tell me you've developed an appetite for this.
And he goes, why don't you give it to that patient you've got tucked away? Like, you can't get nothing by.
Yeah.
Cargom. And undoubtedly, one of my favorite scenes is the examination scene, mm-hmm. where Anthony Hopkins doesn't even realize, like I said, how brilliant Merrick is, and that he can read and think and is very creative. And so he's like preparing him for that interview. And it was a scene I wanted to show, but the whole scene itself is like 5 minutes, very too long for the show. So I'm like, you know what? Let's just talk about it. But the fact that Cargom comes in and Merrick is nervous and just keeps repeating, everyone's very nice. They like,
yeah.
And he thinks that he's just rehearsing lines like a monkey that's been taught to do a repetitive act. And when they walk out and he starts reciting the 23rd Psalm aloud, which Anthony Hopkins had given him the first couple of verses, and he starts to recite out loud, it is such an impactful moment. And then when Anthony Hopkins is like, I didn't teach him this part. And that's that moment in a film where you get the aha, where everything kind of it becomes the film starts to really build at that point. Yeah. And when Cargom comes back in, just the fact that he talks to him a little bit more, and he's like, I didn't know you knew the whole rest of that. And then he's like, yes, I read the Bible quite a lot. It's actually the 23rd Psalm, one of my favorite. And he starts expressing himself, and Cargom looks at him. He goes, when you're done here, come to my office. There's something we need to talk about. And it's just that character that he's like, he's in at this point. And the lengths that he goes to protect Merrick is just so admirable, and it's so fun to watch.
I was convinced at his first appearance that he was going to be someone we spent the whole movie working against, yeah. You know, and so
exact opposite. Yeah.
Yeah. So again, you know, what a joyous surprise to see someone who is initially doubtful, has concerns because the hospital is kind of dedicated to treating a certain type of patient, of which Merrick is not. But seeing someone who kind of starts out with some apprehension, and then as more and more information is gathered, and as feelings develop, is able to change how he feels. And then, like a lot of the characters do in the film, he's very protective of Merrick.
But back to Cargom, if we will, one of the best, I think the best moment he has is when they have the princess Alexandra, if I'm not mistaken, Princess Alexandra, yes, that comes to visit Victoria's sister, if I'm not mistaken, and is representing the queen. And but right before she walks in, Kargom is talking to the board, and you have this one guy, there he is in the bottom right, that is so adamant that he needs to go. We don't have place for something like this. We can't do anything. He needs to go back out of the street. And Kargom sets him up, and it's beautiful. He's like, so let me get this straight. Your answer is no. And he's like, you know, emphatically, then he's like, bringing the princess. Yeah. Like, dude,
what now?
Pulls the rug out from under him. It is probably, again, when you have a movie like this and you have scenes like this, that's what every like scene that goes into the next, builds on getting to that climax. You have to have these bridging scenes, mm-hmm, and they need to be impactful, because if you're going to get to point A to point B in a story, you can't just go right to point B. You have to fill these gaps. And if you, and Wild at Heart, for all it is, those gaps are filled with portions that don't build to the story, that don't impact the overall story in a lot of senses, like the Cousin Del and the car accident and other things. This scene, while it is a minor scene in the film, it's the fact that Kargom shows his comeuppance to this board member. It's clearly stated that Merrick is now there to stay, and you get to this sense in the film that we're going to have a happy ending. They get him a shaving kit. So it really contributes to the overarch of the plot, because then it becomes triumphant. This is kind of, he's ours now. Now, granted, in most films that I've ever seen growing up, especially in a drama, when you get to that high point and everything is going to be, that's when everything falls to shit in a drama. Yeah. That's when you've got to have the rug pulled out and you have to build back up. And I think the Elephant Man tragically does this, because there, you know, John is dancing around his room like he's a prince. He's got his shaving kit. Everything's wonderful. And then his old friend Bites comes to pay him a visit and is like, I'm taking you back. Taking you back. You're mine. It's horrible. Yeah,
it was kind of
it's a downer.
It was a real downer watching him be exploited and kidnapped and then
taken to Belgium,
beaten and then stolen from and then put in a cage.
It's horrible.
Then chased through a train station by some pesky kids, looky loos, some newsies or whatever they were.
Newsies. No. Some terrorizing newsies.
And so that 20 minutes of the film I didn't enjoy, just because, like you said, we had gotten to a really good place with our friend Merrick. Okay, you know what's crazy, Greg, is that we have been talking about the Elephant Man for about 25 minutes or so. Yeah. How many times have we mentioned the words David Lynch?
Oh, true. Yeah.
And that's really interesting to me, because in the other three films, it was an almost constant barrage of, well, you know, Lynch is known for, or, you know, he has a propensity for, or his style of storytelling is, or any number of ways that we invoke David Lynch because he is the creative force behind all of these movies. Here we are talking about the Elephant Man without mentioning him at all. And I think that that says a lot about this movie specifically, that the care that he took, and we have talked about this before several times, the thoughtfulness of the movie, the pacing of it, the way that it develops. It's a movie. You know it's a movie. It's in black and white. You know it's a movie, but it doesn't always feel like you're watching a movie. It just kind of feels like you're watching these people go through these experiences. And you could say that about any movie, because technically that's true. But the way that this felt was less like a movie and more like I'm literally just watching some people go through these different things. So yeah, just how interesting it is that, I mean, of the three movies,
right,
of the three movies we previously talked about, and then this one, I mean, this is as straightforward as you know, there's no tricks to this one. They're not trying to trick you. There's no frills. They're not trying to dazzle you. There's no twists. They're not trying to confuse you.
Right.
There's no leading you one way. There's no bait and switch. There's no some of those things that you rely on when you're trying to be creatively interesting or whatever.
No,
you know, like David Lynch films right. are.
Yeah.
And it doesn't rely on any of that. It relies on a story and it relies on acting and the acting of these actors playing these characters so well that we don't even have to discuss the director, creator of this because it kind of just stands on its own. And how neat is that, that he was able to do that?
You know, and it stands up there with a lot of great movies of all time, not just of the 80s. And of the, you know, of the late 70s, it actually stands up with any really good drama. Now, it was nominated for an Oscar, didn't win. John Hurt was nominated, didn't win, but it did win a ton of BAFTAs, the British version. Sure. But it did win a lot of awards. And the testament to that is that Lynch was able to contain the weirdness of it and Kriplius brings up that Mel Brooks was the producer on this, and a lot of people don't know that. He removed his name because nobody wanted to see a Mel Brooks film in front of the Elephant Man. They would have gone in expecting a whole different type yeah. of film. But it was his film company that he actually founded with Anne Bancroft, his wife, who plays Mrs. Kendall in the film. And so he handpicked Lynch. He knew he'd seen Eraserhead, and he knew that Lynch could handle this. Now, Eraserhead's very surrealistic and weird. And that's not necessarily what this called for, but he knew that Lynch could be that type of director. And there is some surrealism in the beginning when you have the whole elephant scene with the mother, and then you have the surrealism at the end when he ultimately lays down. But what's in the middle is really well done. The use of camera is different than any David Lynch film. When you see Wild at Heart and it gets this, has this real big indie film feel to it. It feels very independent. It's very raw. And then you see this studio type film. You yeah. knew that David Lynch was capable of creating a great studio type film. That just wasn't his bag all the time. So he didn't do a lot of these. There's another one in our top eight called The Straight Story, which is another straight David Lynch film that's not very surrealistic. But this one, he holds back quite a bit. I think it works that way.
Yeah, so. The restraint is good. Now, I will say the little bit at the beginning, I just kind of like took a deep breath and was like, man, I hope this is not like what I'm getting into. I'm not suited for 2 hours of this. And luckily you weren't. It was just a little bookend. Yeah.
Before we get into the next two films, make sure that you set aside time and you get some rest in because okay. you will need your brain for the next two films and the challenges. But
it is one of the things I rely on the least in my life.
But to wrap up this film, yeah, like it does have a sad ending because Merrick passes away, but it also has a beautiful ending where he finally gets to go to the theater and he knows he's dying. And I think that that's one of the things that is so touching is that he gets the standing ovation that Mrs. Kendall leads. He gets to experience, and it's just a nice way to kind of wrap it up. Then he gets to say goodbye to Treves before he lays down on his back and ends up passing away. Now in real life, if you can look up the real story, it strays, but it's a movie. What Lynch did with this was he told an effective story that people remember about, except he used the wrong name.
Yeah.
John instead of Joseph, which is fine. The memoir says John. So even Treves called him John. So that makes me wonder if Treves wrote the memoirs with John Merrick, maybe that's what he called him. Sometimes people go by John or Joseph or something. It happens.
So, Johnny. I always call him Johnny Merrick.
Yeah.
Sounds more like a football player from the 50s, you know, Johnny Merrick, old. Tungsten arm Merrick.
Win one for the Gipper.
Yeah.
But yeah, so yeah, he did have a, David Lynch did extremely well in this one. I think, well, after, you know, this is one of those where I think we don't even really have to vote on this one. I think we've both come to an agreement that Wild at Heart was the better film.
Yeah. You know, Greg, they say that an elephant never forgets.
Did you have this prepared?
And I'll never forget my time watching tonight's winner. The Elephant Man. Oh, man, I wish I could have got through that a little better.
Oh,
that was painful, but I knew it was going to be like from conception in my small little brain to delivery. So, there it was. The Elephant Man, your winner tonight.
It's a clear winner. It's an exceptional film. It's something that I will probably watch again before all is said and done in my life. I really enjoyed it. And I wish it hadn't taken me so long to watch it again. One of the things, though, this movie reminds me of, I watched a lot of just, you know, making of videos and background videos on this. And I saw the funniest story with Bill Hader talking about The Elephant Man when he had seen it in the theaters. And he said that he's in the theater and this dude thought that it was a horror movie. So there's the scene when he sits down with the wife and he's going, "Get her, Elephant Man. Get her." And Bill Hader said he never forgot that because it was the funniest thing that he kept waiting the whole movie for Elephant Man to attack.
Yeah, what a disappointment.
He never attacks. So.
Well, that's the thing. You never know when an elephant's going to attack until it's too late. So you really got to be on your toes the whole movie. Oh, that's funny.
But yeah, that was pretty good. If you get a chance, Bill Hader is like a big Lynch fan. So he had like this 10-minute thing on YouTube that I watched. I thought it was pretty good. But
I'll reach out to Bill and see if we can get him on for the next, maybe for the final four episode we do.
That would be enjoyable. Maybe we could do that. We do have another episode coming up very soon. In 2 weeks, we are going to be doing... Did that scare you? Our theme song scare you, Eric?
No, it didn't scare me. I was pulling up a notepad so I can actually write the movies down we're supposed to watch so I don't have to text you in a week and go, "Oh, hey, dude. What are the movies?"
Well, joining our winner, The Elephant Man, and last episode's winner, Lost Highway, will be one of these two films, either Mulholland Drive or Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me, which is a prequel to the Twin Peaks television series. And we have a special guest joining. I was able to confirm with him today. Unless anything goes wrong, he's very interested in doing it. Ted Felicitet.
Hey, it's a bee.
He will be joining us, the lead singer of Don't Panic, the band founder, and the brother of Rob from Bowling for Soup. He wrote a song called Firewalk With Me, but that is on one of Don't Panic's albums. Big fan of Lynch, big fan of the movie. So tune into that to see Ted from Don't Panic on our next episode of Box Office Battles with Greg and Eric. So that all being said, this is another good night.
Yeah.
It's good movies.
Greg, thanks for the thoughtful conversation. You're a good person to talk about these movies with, so appreciate you, buddy.
I appreciate you too, dude. I really have a good time. When I watch the movies now, I wonder what Eric's going to think about this.
Which part of this is Eric going to freak out about?
Yeah, we kind of had the same feeling about Wild at Heart. It's kind of odd to me because I didn't know how you were going to take it. But hey, we're on a wavelength right now, so let's keep it rolling.
I'm just with you, my man.
Before we sign off, if you want to email us, you can do so at boxofficebattles@gmail.com. You can also find us on Twitch to subscribe at Box Office Battle Pod or YouTube at Box Office Battle Podcast. That being said, anything else you got, Eric, before we go?
Thank you all for joining us. We appreciate you a bunch. Until next time, you guys be excellent to each other. We'll see you then.
See you in 2 weeks, guys, for Mulholland Drive and Twin Peaks Firewalk With Me. Good night.